I'm Brandi Cruz. This is Undivided. Thank you for being here. Thank you for your continuing commitment to give common sense a comeback. I know we can do it. We just got to keep trying. Undivided is presented by our founding sponsor, 1530 Mortgage. Pay them a visit at 1530mortgage.com. And remember, if you have not become a subscriber already, we do an episode like this every single Wednesday that's exclusive to subscribers on Patreon, patreon.com/undivided, or you can become a contributor on my locals community, brandicruz.locals.com. As always, a busy show to get to today. We had a lot of fun on the show on Friday. Unfortunately, we're not going to be having as much fun on the show today because we have a lot to discuss as it pertains to crime, which, as I've said, I believe is the single most pressing issue facing our country right now, certainly facing a lot of cities across the country right now. Last night in Seattle, there was a murder right outside the Amazon Spheres, which is in the heart of the Amazon campus in the city of Seattle. We're going to talk about that and the disastrous domino effect that crime can have on a city. Also, is the Asian American community in Seattle being ignored by progressive leaders when it comes to their concerns over the link between a planned homelessness complex near their neighborhood and crime? Jonathan Cho, independent journalist, senior fellow at the Discovery Institute, is going to join us to talk about a rally that happened a few days ago where there was an overwhelming show from the international district community demanding that elected leaders do better. Plus, remember Governor Jay Inslee backed away from his plan to mandate that state employees get boosters? Instead, they're incentivizing it, and we now know what the incentive is that they're planning to offer those workers. Plus, progressive Congresswoman Pramila Jayapal of Washington State is being blasted by some conservatives for a tweet about 9/11. We'll discuss whether all the rage is justified or maybe an overreaction. But I want to start in the heart of the city of Seattle, certainly the economic heart of the city of Seattle. Last night, there was a murder right outside the Amazon Spheres, which have become really very quickly an iconic place in Seattle. And they are the heart of the Amazon campus in the city. And right outside, there was a murder. It looks like a man in his 50s was shot to death. He was in a vehicle. The suspect fled from the scene. Here is interim police chief Adrian Diaz briefing the media at the scene last night.
At 8:30 p.m., officers responded to 7th Illinois regarding a shooting. Officers located a victim that had been shot inside a vehicle. They attempted life-saving measures, and the 48-year-old male was pronounced deceased at the scene. Currently, our CSI detectives have responded to the scene to process it, and our homicide unit is investigating the scene. If anybody has any additional information, we encourage them to call the Violent Crimes Tip Line at 206-233-5000.
And sorry, the victim, a 48-year-old man. It wasn't immediately clear what, if any, tie that man had to Amazon besides the fact that he was killed right in front of the Amazon Spheres. But this is far from the first time that violence has hit Amazon. You might recall back right before the pandemic began, there was a shooting on 3rd and Pine, which has become a notorious corner for crime in the city of Seattle. 8 people were shot, including a little boy, and 2 Amazon workers were injured in that shooting. You know, the 2 men involved, these were people who were known to law enforcement. They both of them had warrants out for their arrest before that shooting happened. One of them had 44 arrests on his record, at least. As well as 20 criminal convictions. The other one, 15 criminal convictions, about 2 dozen arrests. So these were bad guys. And then they just get in a gunfight in the middle of downtown Seattle. They strike, like I said, a little boy and also injure 2 Amazon workers. And that was really, I think, the first time that we were getting a sense of how dangerous downtown Seattle was becoming. Then, of course, the pandemic hit shortly after this, and what was a huge story at the time faded away a little bit. And then, of course, we saw this spike, this rise in crime during the pandemic. And one of, to date, I've been in Seattle for 12 years, one of the most horrifying pieces of surveillance video tied to a crime that I've ever seen happened during the pandemic. And I'm sure you will remember it. It was a female Amazon worker simply walking down the sidewalk when a man came up behind her, dropped his backpack, wound up and hit her in the back of the head with a baseball bat as hard as he could. This happened in January of this past year. The suspect, 31 years old, had a long history, a long violent criminal history, was homeless at the time that the assault happened. The Amazon engineer who was victimized suffered skull fractures, significant surgery, lucky to be alive. I don't know if lucky is the best word there. But I think the reason this horrified so many people is, you know, you have thousands of Amazon workers who are in this downtown area. And you have this woman just minding her own business, walking on the sidewalk, completely random attack, brutal attack. So now you've got two Amazon workers injured in the shooting. Amazon worker hit at full strength in the back of the head with a baseball bat. And so we saw the shooting happen last night in the 7th and Lenora. Address came out, and people immediately recognized that that was right in front of the Amazon's fears. And regardless of whether there is any sort of connection between the suspect or the victim and Amazon itself, besides just a connection in location, this is an area where you want, as Amazon, your employees to feel safe. You know, Amazon built this campus in downtown Seattle to be this sort of one-stop place for Amazon workers to come, where it could recruit them to come to this wonderful city, you know, live right downtown, work right downtown, enjoy all of these restaurants and these bars. And that is the furthest thing from what it is right now. You know, this campus and that whole area during the pandemic didn't do well economically. You know, you have this entire ecosystem of small businesses that relied on Amazon's workers to be able to thrive. And when those workers weren't out and about every single day, yeah, it had a huge impact on that area. And you combine that, the impact from what closing things down during COVID had on this area, and you combine that with now the horrendous levels of crime that have moved in. And you have to wonder what kind of future Amazon sees in the city. You know, one of the keys, I think, to dealing with the crime crisis in downtown Seattle that we're seeing, and just the prolific open-air drug markets, people just selling stolen merchandise out in the open, victimizing people out in the open, one of the probably most effective ways to deal with that is to get people back to work in downtown Seattle. Is to get these thousands of Amazon workers out and about again, spending money, going to bars, going to restaurants, going to the office. But why on God's green earth would Amazon ever consider doing that? Ever consider telling their employees, hey, it's time to go back to work. It's time to bring downtown Seattle back to life. If this is the kind of stuff that might happen to them. How much is one corporation expected to take? When you look at Amazon's relationship with the city of Seattle, to me, it is a wonder that they're still here. For years, you had the Seattle City Council railing on this tax Amazon proposal, ultimately passing a tax on high-paying jobs that was really intended to be a tax on Amazon. You had Amazon vilified by members of the Seattle City Council for years, completely ignoring things that Amazon had done to be a good corporate citizen, completely ignoring the jobs and the economic growth that Amazon brings to the city. You know, did Amazon bring problems? Of course. You know, rents skyrocketed. That was something that was a clear issue. But, you know, I remember talking to a mayoral candidate in Lorena Gonzalez who said that she didn't believe Amazon was a net good for the city, which is pretty remarkable when you think about it. So you combine the vilification that Amazon has endured, and then you look at the direct targeting of Amazon. For instance, Amazon Go stores have been a regular and repeated target of protests and vandalism and destruction by rioters in the city of Seattle. And Amazon and Starbucks stores seem to be two favorite targets. So you've got Amazon being vilified at the highest levels of Seattle government for a long time. You've got rioters who think Amazon is a terrible company and wants to destroy their storefronts. And then you have a crime crisis that is impacting in a real way the sense of safety and security for Amazon workers. Is Seattle still a city that they can recruit people to come to? Is the downtown area still a place that they can pitch as this wonderful experience for employees who they want to come here? And for Amazon as a corporation, is the city of Seattle and Seattle leadership really an entity that you can trust will work with you to ensure long-term viability? You know, Amazon has already started to move jobs to Bellevue. And I don't know that anyone in their right mind could blame them if they decide to move all of them to Bellevue. I do wish that Seattle leaders would wake up and understand how much this city, especially right now, trying to bounce back from the pandemic, trying to come back to life, how much they do need to cater to Amazon. That they do need to dedicate resources and outreach to trying to not only mend the political relationships that have been broken with Amazon, to not only stop the vilification of Amazon, but to work with Amazon to ensure that their campus is safe, that the downtown area is safe, that they'll bring people back to work, all of that. I mean, Seattle is supposed to be the economic engine for the entire state. And right now, the city of Seattle has a hell of a lot of work to do to keep them here. Concern over crime is also what's at the heart of our next story, which brings us to the International District in Seattle. The following segment is brought to you in partnership with Future 42. Turn your frustration into action by signing up at future42.org. Seattle is a progressive city, right? So what would happen, do you think, if hundreds or thousands of people of color gathered together to protest because they don't feel safe? You know, would the media cover it? Would politicians be there? What do you think would happen? 1,000 people of color come together peacefully to try to send a message to the city that they don't feel safe. Well, we know it would happen, right? Because we saw it all throughout 2020. We saw large protests and gatherings, some of them peaceful, some of them not peaceful, after the murder of George Floyd. Now, I would say that actually most of those crowds were majority white, but they were advocating on behalf of people of color, saying that they were concerned about police brutality. And what happened? The media covered it wall to wall. Wall to wall. I mean, I was part of it. The media covered those protests wall to wall. You had members of the Seattle City Council who showed up at those demonstrations. You had the mayor of the city of Seattle who invited those protesters to City Hall to have meetings, who spoke to them on the steps of City Hall. So we know what would happen in the city of Seattle if there was a crowd of 100 or 200 or 1,000 people of color demanding change. So why then have we heard so little about a protest that happened last week involving about 1,000 members of the Asian American community in Seattle? One of the only journalists who were present for that protest was our friend Jonathan Cho, a former TV reporter in Seattle, now an independent journalist and senior fellow at the Discovery Institute, who's been covering issues of homelessness. Here's some of the clips that he gathered while he was at this protest in the International District.
So all we're asking for is we need to be heard. Officials are quick to do photo opportunities in our neighborhood when they're running for election. But when we need their help, they're nowhere to be found.
If those lawmakers cannot represent us, let us vote them out.
Now, there were a few other very small stories in the news about it, short stories on one of the evening newscasts, but there were TV stations that didn't even bother attending. Again, highly unusual in a city like Seattle that pays so much attention to other protests where you have people of color who are demanding that the city do better. So what was so different about this one? Well, in this case, you had Asian Americans who were protesting over a homeless complex that King County is trying to push through near their neighborhood. They're protesting because they say that they haven't been consulted about it in any meaningful way, and they're concerned that it could lead to an increase in crime in the International District, a neighborhood that's already been dealing with crime in a really serious way.
I wish the decision makers were here, because this is what I want to say to them. How dare you schedule a homeless shelter in our neighborhood?
So again, the concern is that this could bring an element of crime to the international district when they're already dealing with this. And they're saying, look, the city and the county are just pushing this through and they haven't consulted with us. We don't know what their plan is to deal with crime. And it's not my opinion that the county is trying to push this through. The county has said during a recent county council meeting that they're trying to push this forward as quickly as possible. So quickly, in fact, that they want to bypass a competitive bidding process.
And as we look at the unhoused population and our need to rapidly get that done, we see that as being the justification under the code.
To hear more about the concerns that this community is raising over this homeless complex and what seems like the refusal of elected leaders in a progressive city to listen to a community of color that has valid concerns over safety, I spoke to my friend Jonathan Cho about what he saw and what he heard. Jonathan Cho, welcome back to Undivided. You've been busy.
Always.
So tell me about, first and foremost, the homeless complex, quote unquote, that the International District residents are protesting against. What is it?
Okay. So this homeless megaplex being pushed by King County Executive Dow Constantine is his project. It'll be 500 beds, essentially, on this property in Soto at the corner of 6th and Airport Way. It's going to be leased for several years, but 500 beds, which includes RVs. These are, it's going to be an RV lot. It's also going to have tiny homes. It's going to have a sobering center. It's going to have, you know, places for the homeless to get help for drug addiction. So all of this is being placed in the Soto neighborhood, which is known as an industrial district. Problem for Chinatown is that it's literally one block away from the border of Chinatown, directly from the Uwajimaya grocery store, which I'm sure many of your listeners and viewers have been to in Chinatown when they pass through. And the concern now is with all the problems that comes along with a homeless encampment or homeless communities, that's going to start pouring into Chinatown. And there's really no public safety plan at all. And very few details released by Dow Constantine. I want to say for the record, this past March, Dow announced this quietly in a release on the King County website. And just a few weeks ago, Chinatown heard about it for the first time.
So the complex itself sounds to me like it should be non-controversial. We need people off the streets. We need them to go somewhere where they can get help. And this has all that, right? The issue, it sounds like, is the lack of communication and the lack of a plan to deal with public safety.
Yeah. Also lack of community input, but you're absolutely right. And the Chinatown activists and the vast majority in this community say, no doubt that the homeless need a facility like this, but they don't want another one in the CID. And that's one of the biggest problems. The Chinatown activists are saying right now that they are shouldering unfairly this homeless burden because Chinatown already has the Navigation Center, which is, a open, safe drug injection site. And that's caused so many problems over the years. And that's another facility that came in without input into the Chinatown neighborhood. So it's almost like history repeating itself. And the Chinatown activists will also cite that there are at least 10 homeless shelters or support services within a 1 mile square radius of the CID already.
Yeah, a lot of the shelters are down there. And just to play devil's advocate, something this size, 500 beds, are there that's close to the services that already exist downtown? I mean, the industrial district, isn't that kind of the only place that could fit something like that?
It's really hard to say right now. I don't know what other plots of land could be available for lease, but for whatever reason, Dow Constantine chose this piece of land and the CID, along with Soto, and it's going to impact Pioneer Square. A lot of the business owners there and neighbors are just outraged because they were consulted or not consulted in many cases last minute. And they're just hearing about this. And that's become sort of Dow's playbook with his health through housing homeless hotels that have been coming into communities like Redmond and Kirkland as well. The playbook has essentially been King County buys the property. The announcement comes. Then right after that, protests erupt because the community is saying the same thing. we weren't told until after the fact. And that's the key piece here. The CID, other surrounding communities are saying they just weren't consulted. Why not? And they're not getting engagement from Dow Constantine right now. And I've tried numerous times to reach out to his office, and they're essentially choosing not to comment on this.
You did get a chance to confront Mayor Bruce Harrell about it, and he kind of gave you the brush off like this isn't a Seattle problem. Is that fair? And in fact, I'll play the clip here.
The community's really concerned about this new homeless shelter coming into Soto.
Right.
How come they weren't consulted before you green-lighted this?
Well, that's a leading question, what we call it in law, and that's based on facts that are not in evidence, as we say in law. So this is a county project, and I believe they did some amount of outreach and research and talking to communities, and I know that they will continue to do that. So
is there anything you could do to stop this from coming in? Because that's what they want. They want a moratorium.
So again, it's a county project, and so I'm very confident that they will work with the community, listen to the community, and work with the community. And we'll continue to do that as well. I mean, I think we have a history of making sure that we are trying to, and particularly in the Chinatown International District, trying to uplift all boats. I mean, that's what this is about today. That's why we're here, leading our small business recovery efforts, what we're doing with the federal government. So that project, again, I believe intended to house the homeless. I think everyone wants to do. I look forward to the continued outreach that I'm sure the county will do, and we'll do it as well.
I mean, did you feel like he was just shirking responsibility?
Well, in fairness, I have tried to reach out to Mayor Bruce Harrell's office numerous times prior to that encounter. So I sort of caught him off guard at a breakfast last week. But basically what the mayor said was that it's the county's problem. He is aware of what's going on. And I want to be very clear, for the record, he did sign off on it. When this release came out in March, his quote is clearly on the webpage supporting this initiative. So the question now for the mayor is, what can the city do? What can he do to potentially, at the very least, put a pause on this? There's some talk about potentially zoning. Permits haven't been pulled yet, so the mayor could potentially put a stop to that. And again, the CID is recognizing that this could be a done deal. All they're asking for right now is some input and a moratorium, a pause, so they can discuss it and talk about issues like public safety. What's the plan for that? Maybe we need more money for the community as well to prepare for this. None of that has been done. And for now, at least public officials are saying that outreach is starting, again, after the fact. And the problem is, for the CID and other surrounding communities, the shelter is supposed to open this fall.
Well, exactly. It's like, well, this is obviously a done deal, and now we're going to reach out to you. And that community or any neighborhood has every right in the world to be concerned about the public safety concerns that come along with the transient population. I mean, if we're being realistic, they exist. And the International District has already had a ton of issues with this. So you go down to this rally. Were you surprised at how many people were there?
Yeah, it was packed. And what I was really surprised about was the fact that most of the people there were the elders. And I think a lot of people who aren't in Chinatown, when, you know, you're an outsider, you think of Chinatown as a place to get some great dim sum or pick up some trinkets. But there's actually a vibrant community there. And there are actually a lot of seniors who call that place home, low income, who don't speak English. And that was the key. For the first time, they actually at the rally brought in Cantonese translators, because that's the dominant dialect out there, along with multiple other languages. The CID is not just Chinatown. It's also Little Saigon, the Vietnamese community, as well as Japantown. So there's so many different languages. There needed to be, again, according to the organizers of this rally, more time for outreach, more community input, and none of that apparently happened. So a lot of the seniors had a chance to speak out for the first time at this rally, and they were absolutely outraged, especially at the public officials, the city council members like Tammy Morales, who's supposed to be representing them. She has been nowhere, they say, along with King County Council member Joe McDermott, who actually sponsored this shelter. He also represents Chinatown. He's also been nowhere. So essentially, these public officials right now who are Democrats are being accused of only showing up when they want a photo op. But when Chinatown actually needs them, they are MIA.
Well, and that's what's so egregious about this. You know, even Bruce Harrell has used Chinatown as, I don't want to say necessarily a photo op, but he's been down there, you know, painting over graffitied walls, talking about how, you know, they're going to work to keep the open air drug markets and stolen good markets out of there. And to see the images that you captured of these elderly Asian American individuals who are holding up signs with some of these politicians and their faces crossed out, like vote them out of office. What message do you think that sends to the progressives and the Democrats in power who claim to care about communities of color like that one?
I truly believe that the CID, the vast majority of the CID and the Asian American community is starting to lose trust and faith in their Democratic elected officials. Look, the vast majority of Asian Americans and the CID, they have traditionally, historically voted Democrat. But they're at this point right now that they need anyone, and they're going to align with anyone, including Republicans, who will step up to back them at this point. Chinatown, once again, feels like they've always had to fight alone. They're the minority group that's kind of caught in the middle. We all know, Brandy, in the media world, when they talk about, quote unquote, diversity, it's usually Black and white, okay? Then Hispanic, then Asians are last. And this, again, according to Chinatown, they're calling this a social justice issue. They're asking, where's the social justice for them? Where are all these progressive Democratic officials who stood for BLM and every other social justice movement? Where are they right now when the Asian American community needs them?
You know, I thought it was interesting that King County Republican Party sent a few folks there. Do you think that was just them seizing the opportunity? Or, I mean, you heard him speak. Did it feel sincere that they wanted to be there and step up?
First of all, that was totally impromptu. I talked to one of the Republican officials. They said they simply heard about this. They decided to show up. They asked one of the organizers to take the mic and kind of share where they stood. So this was just kind of all fluid. And I was absolutely stunned to see the King County Republican Party officials there. On the flip side of that, I was stunned to see not a single Democratic Party official there to support and stand with Chinatown. So for me, it's almost like a slam dunk. If the Democrats simply show up and publicly say, we stand with Chinatown, we're gonna walk with you, we're gonna work with you to have your voices met, this would be an easy win for Dems. But what this has done is it's created an opening, I believe, for the Republicans, who I believe genuinely wanna stand with Chinatown, but they'll also openly say that the Asian American voting bloc is the fastest growing minority voting bloc, not only in Washington state, but in America. They are seizing on this opportunity to potentially take voters away for the next election cycle.
Yeah, and that's fine. And maybe that changes things down the road. But, you know, you could have every Republican official in King County there, but they're not the ones in power right there right now. They're not the ones with the power to do something about the challenges these communities are facing. So after that show of strength and concern from these individuals in Chinatown, have you heard any movement or momentum from Democratic leaders to take a second look at this homeless complex?
No, but I am hearing that there are Chinatown representatives desperately pleading with these Democratic officials to just step up. This is the time because, again, many in the CID, again, they come from all different political stripes, but have traditionally voted Democrat. And these, you know, representatives from the CID are now saying to the Democrats, please stand with us right now. We don't necessarily want to vote Republican, but we're at this crossroads where we have to align with anyone, especially public officials who are willing to fight with us and stand with us publicly.
Yeah. And if you're going to claim up and down that you care about, you know, minority groups and people of color, words are one thing, actions are another. And I really hope that that community gets the help it needs, because I don't think that the executive's office is going to back off from this proposal. And so what are they going to do on the back end to make sure that things are safe?
Yeah, along with Republican officials, I want to say one last point, along with Republican officials who are jumping in on this, there's also now law enforcement unions that are looking at this very carefully and seeing this as an opportunity to stand up for the Chinatown community.
Yeah, and I hope that's what it's about. I don't want the Chinatown community or the International District, whatever, you know, I know people call it both, to become kind of a political pawn where people say, oh, they're a big voting base, like, let's get in there and you know, show that we care. I hope that people really see what they're dealing with and what they have been dealing with for a long time as it pertains to crime and make an effort to fix things. So Jonathan Cho, great work as always. Really, really, I was to me, I found the images you captured really heartwarming because, I mean, I know that it's unfortunate that these people have to come out like that to have their voices heard, but the fact that you have a community that's willing to do that and stand up and push back, I think is really great.
Yeah, this is the last line of defense. They say this is they've had enough. They say they've been victimized so many times by elected officials and bad public policy that has impacted Chinatown. They feel like they're getting squeezed into a box and their backs are up against the wall. So this is it. They're going to hold the line right here.
Great. And Jonathan Cho, one of the only journalists in Seattle who are who's paying attention to this issue. So thank you for coming on to talk about it.
Thanks, Brandy, for amplifying the story.
Now, I did reach out to the city of Seattle and King County to get comments on all of this. I have not heard back from the city of Seattle yet, but I did hear back from the Department of Community and Human Services for King County. And they put up a blog post about this, and they did say that they met with the rally organizers last week, and they are going to continue to meet with members of the community as the planning process moves forward. They also say they're working to correct misinformation that's being spread about this project. I did ask them what specifically is the misinformation that they're working to clear up. But look, regardless of what the city or the county feels like they've done in this instance, clearly the community members don't think it's enough. Clearly, the community members don't feel informed enough about what's going on. We can all agree, all common sense people can agree that you need shelters like the one that they're going to build, places to get people inside, places to get people services. But you have to communicate with the people around those areas to let them know what your plan is, if anything, to deal with the crime that is going to come up as a result. Those communities deserve that. And when you're in a city like Seattle, when you have progressive leadership that says over and over and over how much it prioritizes communities of color, cares about communities of color, you have to actually have action behind those words. The previous segment was brought to you in partnership with Future 42. Turn your frustration into action at future42.org. Transitioning into the topic of COVID-19, we've been discussing a lot the vaccine mandates, which I'm opposed to, and the fact that in Washington state, Governor Jay Inslee has now settled on this policy that doesn't make a whole lot of sense. Essentially, if you're a state worker under the mandate, you're not required to get boosters. You just had to have had the original vaccine. And that also goes for new hires. So if I'm someone who walks in to work for the state, and I got the original vaccine back in July of 2021, but I didn't get any boosters, I can get hired. Even though the original vaccine has worn off. So it's as if I'm coming in unvaccinated. But if I'm someone who comes in and I never got the original vaccine, I can't get hired by the state. So you can see how this really doesn't make any sense. Now, initially, the governor had planned to mandate boosters, but there was enough pushback. They're short-staffed in enough sectors that the governor quickly changed course, saying instead he was going to move to an incentive-based program. He was asked, I was watching the press conference last week where he announced an end to the COVID state of emergency on October 31st, and there was also a little nugget in there where he was asked by one of the reporters if they've figured out what the incentive program is going to look like for COVID-19 boosters.
You know what those incentives might be?
I don't have those in mind at the moment. I think we have some discussions with our unions about that that's ongoing, I think.
Well, the governor doesn't apparently know what the vaccine booster incentives are, but we do on the Undivided podcast, at least for several agencies that are going through contract negotiations. So the Department of Corrections is one of them. We know that there's been short staffing in our DOC or state prison system. And so I'm very glad that boosters aren't going to be mandated. I do think that's good because I think it would have led to more people leaving who relented on the original vaccine but weren't willing to relent again when it came to the boosters. So I was sent an internal document related to the negotiations that are ongoing between the state and the DOC union that says that the state is offering to give workers a $1,000 payment if they get boosted for COVID-19. Similarly, I got my hands on an internal document related to the negotiations between the State Troopers Association and the state. And similarly, troopers are being offered a one-time $1,000 payment if they get the COVID booster. So So now the state has resorted to, with taxpayer funds, it appears, bribing state employees to get boosted for COVID-19. And of course, this is going to result in a couple things. First of all, there are going to be people who are just fine getting boosted, who have planned to get boosted all along, who are now going to say, oh, well, I get money now for getting a vaccine or a booster that I was going to get anyway. And so at that point, it's just a gifting of taxpayer funds to people who didn't need to be incentivized to get the COVID booster. On the other hand, you put people in an interesting situation who don't want it, never did want it, but maybe they're hurting financially and they could use $1,000. And now you have the state bribing them to get a booster that they never really wanted in the first place. But I think what's most egregious here is that even for people who do get a booster, boosters like the vaccine wane in efficacy over time. We know that that's just science. So you're going to give $1,000 in taxpayer money to however many state workers end up getting a booster. And then in a few months when that booster wears off, there isn't anything set up for a second $1,000 payment or a third $1,000 payment or a fourth $1,000 payment if you need to get a booster every 4 months. So you could have people cash in, get a booster this one time, and then they don't get any boosters after that, and then they're not protected against COVID-19 anymore to the extent that the vaccine protects people from COVID-19. So at this point, this is really the governor's office just trying to keep up this charade of trying to continue to act as if any of this makes sense. But they're keeping up the charade with taxpayer money, with $1,000 a pop. I'm genuinely curious if you guys think, even if you're in favor of the vaccine or not, if you believe at this juncture that it's appropriate for the state to be bribing people to get boosted. And then let's say you have an approved exemption from getting the vaccine. Maybe you have a medical exemption. Well, now all these other people who can get the booster, who can get the vaccine, who want to, get $1,000 and you don't get anything because medically you can't get the vaccine. I just think that this is a continuation of this sort of charade that the governor is keeping on. I think it's very clear at this point that the what the governor has set up doesn't make any sense, you know, to mandate the original vaccine, but then not any boosters, and to give people $1,000 once to get a booster, and there's nothing saying that they're going to continue to get boosters or going to continue to get the COVID vaccine. This is just the governor trying as best he can to continue to pretend that any of this makes sense. Similarly, on the COVID-19 front, I was kind of poking fun at Governor Jay Inslee on Friday's show for saying, hey, we're going to be out of the COVID-19 state of emergency on October 31st. But then he was asked by a reporter, oh, do we still have to wear masks while we're sitting here in front of you then? And the governor didn't have an answer for that.
Will we have to wear masks after October 31st to sit in this room with you?
I doubt it, but I don't know for sure. You got to talk to Jamie.
But to the governor's credit, the governor does not require that those reporters show proof of a COVID-19 vaccine or booster to be at the press conference. That is not the case for Washington State Attorney General Bob Ferguson's office. I've talked about this on the podcast a couple times, and I just wanted to give you guys an update. So I was pretty horrified a few months ago to find out that as a member of the media, in order to attend a press conference at the Attorney General's office in Washington State, you have to not only show proof of a COVID vaccine, but proof that you are up to date on recommended boosters. Which meant that I haven't got boosted, would not be able to go to a press conference to cover one of the most powerful politicians in Washington State. And I found that to be simply egregious. And I had reached out at the time to the Attorney General's office to inquire about the policy, to ask why they wouldn't make an exception for journalists. And what they told me is that this was a policy put in place for all visitors to access their offices. And it was a policy that was ratified by the employees, so it was basically agreed upon that anybody who comes into the AG's offices must show proof that they are vaccinated and up to date on their boosters, which maybe was fine 8 months ago, but certainly doesn't make any sense now. And if the goal, I would assume, based on that policy, is to keep people in the Attorney General's office from getting sick, even if I'm fully vaxxed and boosted, I can still give COVID-19 to you. So inherently, the policy isn't going to protect against what they think it's going to protect against, or what they claim to think it's going to protect against. So surely, in light of Governor Jay Inslee's announcement that we are soon to be past the emergency phase of the pandemic, that even he and his office doesn't require, even Governor Jay Inslee, who has required just about everything a governor can require during the pandemic, even he does not require reporters to be vaxxed and boosted, or vaxxed or boosted, to sit and ask him questions. Yet the Attorney General's office does. So I reached back out to them to say, hey, given the governor's latest announcement, are you guys going to roll this policy back? And here's the response I got. Thanks, Brandy. As you know, because our employees ratified this policy, this is not a change that can be made unilaterally, nor would we want to make it unilaterally. We cannot change this policy without agreement with our union partners. This is not a policy exclusive to press conferences. It is a policy for all visitors accessing the secure portions of our 13 offices around the state. The policy was made with our employees' safety in mind as we reopened our office, and any changes will be made in collaboration and partnership with our employees. So here would be my message to employees of the Washington State Attorney General's office. It is time to change your policy. There is nothing at this point that would validate the concerns you had that someone entering the office unvaccinated could give you COVID-19, any different than someone who is vaccinated who enters can spread COVID-19 to you. And there is no reason to prioritize a vaccine and a booster ahead of the right of the free press to question one of the most powerful elected officials in the state, someone who, by the way, would like to be the next governor of the state of Washington. The time to change the policy was yesterday, and I really do hope that they reconsider it moving forward. Okay, yesterday was 9/11, obviously an important day for our country. Well, a lot of politicians put out, you know, tweets or Facebook posts with some sort of remembrance. And Congresswoman Pramila Jayapal of Washington State, the chair of the House Progressive Caucus, was no different. She put out a tweet that said, "Today we remember the 2,996 people who were killed on 9/11 and all those who lost their lives while serving our country in the forever wars that followed." Well, the only problem with that tweet is that 2,996 people were not killed on 9/11. 2,977 were, unless you include the 19 terrorists who were involved in the attack on 9/11 and who died as a result, who committed suicide as a result in their efforts to attack America. Usually, as an American politician, you would not include the terrorists as part of the total number of those whose lives were taken on 9/11. So Congresswoman Pramila Jayapal instantly gets a ton of heat for this from Republicans. And some internet sleuths note that she actually sent the exact same tweet out, word for word, same picture and everything, pictures of the Twin Towers saying never forget, on the same date last year in 2021. So you had some Republicans, including friends of mine, my friend Jason Rance, put out a tweet criticizing Congresswoman Jayapal for this, and just all over. And there was an article in the New York Post entitled, "Dem Rep Jayapal Slammed for 9/11 Tweets Counting Terrorists and Death Toll." And she since removed that tweet, by the way. Here's my thing. I can get angry about stuff. But I really think this is an example where if you're outraged about everything, then you're outraged about absolutely nothing. To me, there are a million other explanations for this tweet besides Congresswoman Jayapal mourning the lives of 19 terrorists. First and foremost, again, let's put our common sense cap on. Do you really think that it is Congresswoman Jayapal herself who is sending out that tweet? No, it's probably a member of her staff who's sending out that tweet, as evidenced by the fact that it is the exact same tweet that was sent out on September 11th of 2021. So they're probably like, oh, what did we put out last year? Well, let's just put out the same exact thing this year. Now, it's fair to say Congresswoman Jayapal still has to be accountable for anything that goes out on her Twitter account. But the idea that this was something that was intentionally done, as opposed to, you know, back in 2021, some staffer Googling how many people died on 9/11, finding some figure, pasting it in there, and calling it good. How many of you, and be honest, could at a moment's notice say how many, if I asked you how many people died on 9/11, and you could give me the exact correct figure. Clearly somebody was going to have to Google it. My guess is they Googled it. The first figure they stumbled upon was a figure that included the total number dead without bifurcating the number of victims from the number of attackers. And that's the number they put. And then this year, staff went back, scooped up the exact same tweet, and put it out there. To think that this was malicious is just an example of, I think, people rushing, depending on politics, to just attack someone. And I have further evidence to back that up. House Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy also put out a tweet about 9/11 yesterday. And he also used the incorrect number. He said, we can never forget not just the 2,996 souls we lost on 9/11, but also the first responders who ran into buildings and those who sacrificed to stop Flight 93. Do you really believe that Kevin McCarthy is intentionally mourning the lost souls of 19 terrorists? No, he just got the number wrong, probably for the same reason. Some staffer went on Googled, and found an incorrect number that conflated the two figures. I did notice that there wasn't as much anger directed at Kevin McCarthy as there was directed at Congresswoman Pramila Jayapal. Why? We talk about this all the time. Because everything is about politics. Sometimes politicians who you don't agree with are going to make honest mistakes. And getting enraged by honest mistakes only makes fewer people pay attention when there is actually something to be upset about. All right, we like to end the show on Mondays by reading some of your comments. I wanted to get some of your reactions to Governor Jay Inslee deciding to end the state of emergency around COVID coming up on October 31st. I also, in case you missed the show on Friday, I had a little dance party at the beginning. I realized that I'm not the best dancer, but my moves were classic. Anyway, Curtis responded to my dancing and said, getting closer to the OnlyFans page, huh? Many start dancing, and the next thing you know, they're working the pole. Well, Curtis, I have no intention of starting an OnlyFans page, you wish. And I also have no intention of stripping. I'm not sure really anyone would want to see that, but thank you for your input. Molly said, in regards to my comments that employees who were fired over the vaccine mandate should be rehired, she does not agree. She said, the employees that were fired for cause. They were required to get vaccinated and refused, so they were fired. Rich, in talking about the end of the COVID state of emergency, said, I'm not going to hold my breath. He'll find an excuse to keep it in place last minute. Rich, I tend to agree that I don't think we can really celebrate until it actually happens. Monica said, heck, even our legislators did not have the guts to rein him in a while back when they had the chance. And I do wonder, Monica, if that'll change. You know, state lawmakers in Olympia, there was a lot of pressure from Republicans for Democrats to join together with them to rein in Governor Jay Inslee's emergency powers, to put some sort of checks and balances whereby the legislature would have the opportunity to sign off on the continuation of a state of emergency. Democrats failed to do that. But I do wonder if it'll be different this upcoming session, since presumably we'll no longer be in a state of emergency. You know, I found some merit in the argument that, hey, let's not change this while we're in the midst of something. Let's change it after. So maybe they'll find the political will to do it this year. And let's end with Jay. Jay wrote, if the media would have held him accountable early on, it maybe wouldn't have gone this far. Jay, I agree. That's it for this episode of Undivided. Thank you for being here. Thank you for your continuing commitment to give Common Sense a comeback. You can become an Undivided subscriber, get a bonus episode every week at patreon.com/undivided or by becoming a contributor on my locals community, brandycruz.locals.com. Undivided is presented by our founding sponsor, 1530 Mortgage. Visit them at 1530mortgage.com.